Dr. Long is a native of Atlanta, Georgia. Since 1997, he has served as the Director of Congregational Resources and the Director of Geneva Press, Presbyterian Publishing Corporation. As his present calling indicates, Dr. Long is a pastor in the Reformed tradition. Receiving his MDiv degree from Erskine Theological Seminary in 1971, he earned his PhD degree from Princeton Theological Seminary, Princeton, New Jersey, in 1980. He was a teaching fellow at Princeton Seminary, 1974 to 1975. Then, following teaching assignments at both Erskine Seminary and Columbia Theological Seminary, Decatur, Georgia, he returned to Princeton Seminary in 1983, where he served first as associate professor and then as the distinguished Francis Landy Patton Professor of Preaching and Worship, 1988 to 1997. In the course of his professional calling, Dr. Long has served as president of the Academy of Homiletics in 1989 and editor of Theology Today, 1990 to 1997. He was senior homiletics editor for the New Interpreter's Bible. Newsweek named him one of the 12 most effective preachers in the English-speaking world. We should note Dr. Long's extensive writings include two New Testament commentaries, Hebrews, prepared for the John Knox Press publication, Interpretation, Bible Commentary for Teaching and Preaching, and Matthew, appearing in the Westminster Bible Companion series. His creative and prolific pen has yielded numerous volumes of sermons and devotional literature, as well as chapters appearing in homiletical anthologies and source books. He has written a multitude of articles published by prestigious journals and treating subjects ranging from pastoral theology to preaching and worship to helps for the local church. His principal works for homileticians are used widely in seminaries and by practitioners of the preaching craft. His basic homiletics is The Witness of Preaching, a text in use here at Concordia Seminary. Many in this audience this morning recall fondly Dr. Long's first visit to Concordia Seminary when he presented the 1996 Wenchel Preaching Lectures. Those lectures appeared in print in the October 1996 issue of the Concordia Journal under the title, The Life to Come, Preaching with Hope. I think it is noteworthy that among Dr. Long's many writings and publications are several charitable tributes published in honor of numerous of his colleagues. This hour, I submit, we turn the tables and we honor Dr. Long with our listening ears, our attentive minds, and our waiting hearts. Dr. Long, our guests, join students and faculty to extend cordial greetings and a warm welcome upon your return to these halls of Concordia Seminary.
Well, I am absolutely thrilled to be a part of this conference. I think there is a renaissance going on in biblical preaching today, and this conference is a part of it. Part of the reason why we're having a renaissance, I think, is because of some interesting things happening in biblical hermeneutics that are much more preacher-friendly. I'm going to be talking about that in the rest of the hour. But also, what appears to be a dilemma in the life of the church is actually invigorating to biblical preaching. The fact that we are now looking out on Sunday morning at congregations who don't know, and know they don't know. They used to know, but they don't know anymore, and they want to know. They don't know the biblical materials. One of the problems with biblical preaching is when preachers think that they and their congregations are bored with this stuff. We preachers sometimes treat the Bible as if it were a senile dinner companion. who keep saying the same stories over and over again. And so if there's going to be anything interesting in the sermon, I have to put it in there. But they've not heard these stories. I know a man in North Carolina who, instead of doing the object lesson children's sermon, you know those, how those go. Good morning. It's so good to see you here. I have a question. What are these? Johnny, yes, that's right. These are glasses. Now, how is the Bible like these glasses? T.S. Eliot couldn't make that cognitive leap. Instead of doing the typical children's sermon, he's telling Bible stories. And he has not only the children on the edge of their seats, but the adults who have not heard them before or who have forgotten them leaning forward. At the door one day, someone said, "I really love your children's sermons, but where are you getting all those weird stories?" That kind of environment is a place of ferment for biblical preaching. When I was teaching at Princeton Seminary, I was preaching somewhere some Sunday morning, and after the sermon, I was standing at the door, shaking hands, as we are wont to do, and suddenly my preacher's radar picked up this woman moving with purpose in my direction. I looked over there, and she was about 70-something years old. She had a flinty, thin face. She looked sort of like a hatchet dipped in vinegar. When she got up to me, she said, "You teach preaching in the seminary, don't you?" "Yes." "Well, I have something I want you to tell your students." "Okay." "Tell them to take me seriously." And with that, she disappeared into the morning mist. What did she mean? Take me seriously as a woman? Maybe so. Take me seriously as a senior citizen? Maybe so. But I think what she actually meant was, I'm sick and tired of cotton candy sermons. I want you to take me seriously as a thinking, ethical being. And one of the best ways I submit to take her seriously is to take the text seriously on her behalf. And that's what this conference is about. It's about careful and creative biblical preaching. And both of those words are important, careful and creative. One day in homiletics class, one of my students got up to preach, opened up the text, and said, "Before I preach this morning, I'd like to say a little bit about the text." I thought, "You numbskull." Careful means the text governs the preaching. But creative means that we have the freedom of the gospel, that we're able to encounter the text in some rich and imaginative ways. When I graduated from seminary, what I had been taught was that the text was this foreboding vessel with a theological idea somewhere in it. And my job was to exegetically put on sterile surgical gloves and gingerly and somewhat fearfully to approach the text in my study, reach around inside there until I had found the theological biblical idea, lift it out, and without tampering with it, drop it on my congregation on Sunday morning. This is the word of God. It doesn't come in ways that we have to handle it with sterile gloves. It comes like Jesus came to engage us. It comes more like a dance partner. It wants to lead, but it wants us on the floor moving with it. And that's what we want to talk about this morning, because what we're talking about this morning is a revolution occurring in biblical hermeneutics and in preaching that understands the biblical writers to be poets and artists who wrote with just the right language in just the right way to create an impact on those who read the text. Now, this is not the only revolution in biblical hermeneutics to which we are preachers and heirs. This is, in fact, the third major revolution in biblical understanding, and all of them are important for us. The first revolution in biblical understanding occurred a number of centuries ago, And it was the discovery that when the biblical words come to us in the form of the text, they come historically grounded. Now, we've fought over that through the centuries, of course, but there is an amazing consensus about that today, that it, to our own degree of understanding and with our own methodologies, we understand that this text comes in historical context, and if we're going to understand it and preach it, we have to take into account the historical setting out of which the text comes. For example, we think that the Gospel of Mark was written to an impoverished community economically. The Church of St. Mark has the paint peeling on the walls. The Church of St. Luke, right across the street, is an economically mixed community. The lords and ladies are coming with their servants, both to the congregation of St. Luke. The Church of St. Matthew, on the third corner, is affluent. There are Beamers and Lexuses in the parking lot of the Church of St. Matthew. Church of St. John, we won't talk about. They don't have a building. They're strumming guitars. They'll know we are Christians by our love, by our law. We'll leave them for a minute. But the Church of St. Mark impoverished, the Church of St. Luke mixed, the Church of St. Matthew wealthy. In all three Gospels, Jesus sends the disciples out two by two, and in each case he says to them, take no money. In the Gospel of Mark, it says, take no copper, take no pennies. In Luke, it says, take no silver. And in Matthew, it says, take no copper, silver, or gold. They're going out with American Express gold cards from Matthew's church. In the Gospel of Mark, the disciples are arguing about who is the greatest, who is the greatest, who is the greatest, and Jesus interrupts that by saying, if you want to be great, notice the language, if you want to be great, what does that imply? They aren't great. You must become as a servant. Same debate takes place in the Gospel of Luke. It happens at the Last Supper, at the Lord's table, and Jesus interrupts that debate and says, those among you who are great must become as those who wait on tables. Notice the difference. There are some great ones. But up at the big house, the servants wait on the Lord and Lady, but down at the Lord's table, the servants get to sit, and those who are in power in the world become the deacons, the servants. You can feel the historical circumstances in the text. That's the first revolution. The second revolution in biblical understanding happened about 75 years ago, and that was when we began to discover that biblical texts were not only historically grounded, but they were also theologically shaped, that the writers of the text had particular theological agenda. For example, you can tell the difference in Mark and Matthew's theological agenda by looking at the way they treat the disciples. They don't treat the disciples exactly the same way. In Mark, the disciples never get it. They are always out to lunch. In fact, in one text, they're literally out to lunch. Jesus and the disciples are in a boat going across the Sea of Galilee. Jesus is in one end of the boat, the disciples are in the other. The disciples at their end of the boat are talking about lunch. Did you bring lunch? I didn't bring lunch. It wasn't my responsibility to bring lunch. I was in charge of the banquet at Capernaum. I can't be responsible for everything. In the middle of this, Jesus says, beware of the leaven of Herod and the leaven of the Pharisees. They say, he's mad at us because we didn't bring lunch. What are you talking about, lunch? Now, in Mark, that's where it ends, but in Matthew, at the end of that pericope, it says, then they understood. In Mark, they don't understand. In Matthew, they do. In Mark, when Jesus tells the parable of a seed that falls on four different kinds of soil, it's the first parable he preaches in public, the disciples gather around afterwards and say, what are you talking about? And Jesus says, you don't understand that parable? You don't understand, that's the first parable. You don't understand that one? How will you understand any of them? That's Mark. In Matthew, Jesus tells the same parable in Matthew 13, then he piles on 6 more parables, each of them more difficult than the one before. 1,000 books in the library here trying to understand those parables. Nobody gets them. At the end of the string, Jesus turns to the disciples, the same disciples, and says, "Do you understand all this?" And they say, "Yes." Now, what's going on here? Theologically, Mark wants to make the case that the salvific purposes of God march on even when human beings don't understand them. Matthew wants to make the theological point that when the gospel is proclaimed, human beings can stand up and say, "I will respond to that." Now, some Sundays I sit in the pew of the Church of St. Mark. I don't get it, and praise be to God that God's redemption moves on in spite of me. Other Sundays, there's racial turmoil in my community, and the gospel is clear, and it is time for some of us to stand up and say, to the best of our ability as human beings, we will respond to this in ethical responsibility. Church of St. Matthew, sometimes I'm in that pew. Theological differences. I was telling some of you that there is a difference theologically between the Synoptic Gospels and the Gospel of John about time, To put it in broad terms, for the Synoptic Gospels, the kingdom of God is in the future. We're marching to Zion, beautiful, beautiful Zion. We're not there yet, but we'll get there one day. It's coming, I promise. For John, it's almost as if he reached out and took that future kingdom and pulled it as a canopy over time, so that when you ask Matthew, "Where's the kingdom of heaven, Matthew?" Matthew will say, "It's ahead of us." John, "Where's the kingdom?" "It's above us." And the kingdom in John, like a sewing machine, spikes down into ordinary time so that you experience it in a sign. You see the fullness of the thing. You can tell this theological difference in the Lazarus story in John. Lazarus is dead. Jesus is late. When he finally gets there, he circles the airport around Bethany until finally the sisters of Lazarus come out. Martha comes out and says, "If you had been here, our brother would not have died." To which Jesus says, "Your brother will rise again." I know he will rise again at the last day." And Jesus says, no, Martha, that's the Gospel of Matthew. We're in the Gospel of John here." "I am the resurrection and the life." Now, John's theology gives us ecstasy. You can go to the grocery store and experience the kingdom in the Gospel of John. Matthew's gospel gives us the ability to read the newspaper and know that we live in a Good Friday world, but that the kingdom is coming. Thank God for both of those theological emphases. 25 or 30 years ago, however, to those two revolutions, historical and theological, a third was added, and that's what's going to consume the rest of our attention this hour. And that was the literary critical revolution, the understanding that biblical writers were not only historically grounded and theologically keen, but that they were also poets and artists who knew how to shape language to cause things to happen. They didn't just talk about the gospel. They wrote about the gospel in such a way that when you read it and heard it, it happened in your life. For example, the writer of the Gospel of John uses a literary device about 6 or 7 times that I call question, answer, dumb response. And the way it works is this: somebody in John's Gospel will ask Jesus a question. It'll be a good question, but it'll be a question at the mundane, routine, everyday, ordinary level of life. Jesus will answer the question, but he won't answer it at that level. He'll answer it at the level of Johannine Christology, at the level of eternal life, causing, of course, the answer to whistle right over the head of the person who's asked the question and evincing from them some banal, insipid response. Woman at the well. "Why is it that you, a Jew, ask of me, a Samaritan woman, for a drink?" That's a darn good question. Why would a Jewish male break down racial, ethnic, gender differences to ask a Samaritan female for a drink of water? Why is it that you, a Jew, ask of me, a Samaritan woman, for a drink? Answer: if you knew who was asking, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. Where are you going to get this water? You hadn't even got a bucket. Now, that laughter is what John's literary structure is after. Because in your laughter, you have discerned the gospel. He doesn't mean that well. He means, and you have perceived the miracle of the gospel of John. Do you remember in the gospel of Luke, the crucifixion is happening, and the narrator of Luke says, the women and the others who followed Jesus watched these things from a distance. Now, who cares? Who cares how far the witnesses to the crucifixion were? The Greek word, by the way, is makron. It means from afar, at a distance. The women and the others who followed Jesus watched the crucifixion makron, from a distance. I wonder if the writer of Luke, Acts, ever used that word makron in any other setting. I will arise and go to my father and say, I am not worthy to be treated as a son. Treat me as a slave. But while he was still makron, his father ran to him, bring a ring, bring a robe. Two men went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, the other a publican. The Pharisee stood and said, oh God, I'm thankful that I'm not like other people. But the other stood makron. God be merciful to me, a sinner. See what's happening here? Makron is not a tape measure. It's a poetic, literary, theological symbol for the distance we stand before grace. So that in Acts, Peter's Pentecost sermon ends this way. This good news is for you and for your children and for everyone who stands makron. Poetry of the text. Now, having understood that texts are in poetic, rhetorically sophisticated, artistic fashion, biblical preachers began to exploit this, began to understand that this has an impact on the way we preach, because when texts come to us, they come in that was normal American social greeting. And Alan knew the script. As soon as I said, hi, I'm Tom Long, he knew he's supposed to say, hi, I'm Alan. And as soon as I said, how are you, he knew that he was supposed to say, fine. We both know the script because the normal American social greeting is what literary critics would call a genre. A genre is an agreement among speaking and reading participants in a culture about certain patterns of communication. And as soon as I entered into it, he knew how he was supposed to engage it and respond. If I had said, how are you? And he had said, well, I'm not so good. I got some x-rays here I'd like you to take a look at. He would have misunderstood the genre. If I had been speaking to 1,500 people and come to the microphone, good evening. My name is Tom Long. And Alan stood up in the back and said, hi, Tom, I'm Alan. How are you? He would have misunderstood the genre. But he understood the genre because we are both competent speakers of American English. Biblical texts come to us in generic patterns. Psalms are different from Proverbs. Proverbs are different from parables. Parables are different from historical sagas. Historical sagas are different from epistles. And the wise biblical preacher knows that when a biblical text comes at you in a particular pattern, you're supposed to calibrate your reading competence given the pattern that comes at you so that you end up interpreting a psalm different from the way that you would interpret a parable or a proverb. Now let's take a look at a biblical text. I'm hoping that you can see this. Only the righteous can read this. Can you see that okay? Is that in focus? Is that pretty much in focus? I want to take a look at Exodus 22. It says, "If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you shall not deal with them as a creditor. You shall not exact interest from them. If you take your neighbor's cloak in pawn, you shall restore it before the sun goes down, for it may be your neighbor's only clothing to use as a cover. In what else shall that person sleep? And if your neighbor cries out to me, I will listen, for I am compassionate." All right, now, generically speaking, in terms of literary form, this is what is known as casuistic law. There are two forms of law in the Old Testament, apodictic and casuistic. Apodictic is a law that simply states the rule. You shall not operate a motor vehicle over 20 miles an hour in a school zone. That's apodictic. Casuistic, on the other hand, is law addressed to a particular case, a particular situation. Now, there's a piece of casuistic law. If you take your neighbor's cloak in pawn, that's the case, then this is what you shall do. Now, I don't know about you, but that doesn't seem like a very promising preaching text to me. I think I'll move on to something else in the lectionary on this Sunday. Or, if I had to preach this, I would say, Lutheran style, here's the law, let's go to Paul and see what Paul does with the law vis-a-vis the gospel and leave this behind. But I want to suggest, no. I want to suggest that what we have here is a genre that invites us into a dialogical process if you know how to read. Just as Alan knew how to respond to my social greeting, if you know how to read casuistic law, then this is what happens. Let's take it clause by clause. It begins with the case, and the case is, if you lend money to my people, specifically, if you take your neighbor's cloak in pawn, if you take your neighbor's coat in pawn. Now, unless you're a pawnbroker, you probably aren't literally going to do that. But what this does is to bring the reader into the world of ordinary economic discourse. If you take your neighbor's Visa card, if you take your neighbor's house as collateral on a loan, this is the world of ordinary buying, selling, credit, economic life. So if you participate in American economic society, especially on the side of power. That's what this is. If you take your neighbor's cloak in pawn, law, second clause, you shall restore it before the sun goes down. Now that's absurd. If you have to give the guy's coat back that you've taken as collateral on a loan at sundown, then you no longer have any hold over the guy. And the point of having collateral is to have hold over the guy. So there is built into the dialogue here an unstated protest. What? Give his cloak back before sundown? Why? And then the law responds to your protest. For it may be your neighbor's only clothing to use as cover. That sets up another protest. Well, tough. I mean, that's what collateral is. If it weren't dear and precious, then it wouldn't be any hold over the loan. Sure, it's his only coat, but he should have known that going into the deal. A deal is a deal. Second answer. In what else shall that person sleep? Oh, my God. Now the law has not allowed you to remain at arm's length from your neighbor. The law has brought you into your neighbor's bedchamber, and you see him there, shivering in the night, because he doesn't have the cloak that you hold in pawn. Now I've got a dilemma. I mean, I'm feeling some sympathy for the guy shivering in the cold, but that's not the way the world works. I mean, the world works that I get to keep the thing because I lent him the money. I mean, what am I going to do here? I'm being torn in two directions, and the law wants me to give him the... But... And suddenly, the shallow law drops into a deep theological pool. If your neighbor cries out to me, I will listen, for I am compassionate. Suddenly now, we don't merely have a law. We have two worlds before us, a world of ordinary economic discourse and a world based on the compassion of God. Which one do you want to be a part of? Now, you see how the literary structure of this particular passage has led me to a theological discovery about what the world rests on that calls into question my participation in the ordinary round of economic life, such that I have to make a discipleship decision. Now, I can preach a sermon about that. I can also structure my sermon, if I wish, according to that pattern. I can start us off in the ordinary world of economic life, and then I can claim the gospel, and I can set up protests and respond to those protests, moving, ratcheting deeper and deeper until the disclosure of the compassion of God, the same way that the text does. Is that a good thing to do in preaching? I think it is. I also think that the biblical writers themselves did it. For example, have you ever noticed the ending of the 13th chapter of the Gospel of Mark? 13th chapter of Mark is the little apocalypse, as you know. It's about the second coming, the parousia. And at the end of it, Jesus says to the disciples, "But about that day or hour, no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Beware, keep alert. You don't know when the time will come." It's like a man going on a journey who, when he leaves home and puts his slaves in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to be on the watch. "Therefore, keep awake. You don't know when the master of the house will come, in the evening or at midnight or at cockcrow or at dawn. Or else he may come and find you asleep. And what I say to all, keep awake." Now, flat-footedly, what that text says is, look, I don't know when the second coming is going to be. You don't know when it's going to be. The angels don't know when it's going to be. Only the Father in heaven knows when it's going to be. But I'll tell you what it's going to be like. It's going to be like a guy going on vacation who leaves his house in charge of servants and says, "I'm coming back, but I'm not going to tell you when, because I want you to keep this place straight. I don't want to come back and find this place in a clutter, so I'm not going to tell you. I could come back at any watch in the Roman night. I could come back in the evening. I could come back at midnight. I could come back at cockcrow. I could come back at dawn." Those were the four watches in the Roman night: evening, midnight, cockcrow, at dawn. I could come back at any of those. So you watch and you stay awake. You understand? Yeah, I understand. You know what Mark does with that? He could come back in the evening. If you read on in Mark, it says, "When it was evening, his disciples were with him, and he said, 'One of you will betray me.'" Could come in the evening. Could come at midnight. Mark says, later that night, they went to the garden, and he said, "Watch while I pray." And he prayed that great prayer, and when he came out, he found them asleep. Couldn't you watch an hour? Could come in the evening. Could come at midnight. He could come at cockcrow. Weren't you with him? No, I wasn't with him. Yes, you were. Yes, you were with him. And the cock crew. Could come in the morning. And when it was morning, the narrator says, they handed him over to be crucified. Tick. Talk. Mark is using the literary structure of Jesus' own parable to shape the passion story. to show that every tick of the clock is full of moments of loyalty and betrayal, denial and faith. The genre of the text. Now, what I want to do is to take a look at several examples of several different genres and see what we might want to do with them. We're going to be asking, what is this genre, whether it's a psalm or a story or a parable or whatever, and then we're going to be saying, what does this genre do that other genres don't do or don't do as well, and how does it do it? What are the levers and pulleys and elements and devices that that genre uses so that the preacher can pay attention to those? Let's start with the most prevalent generic form in Scripture. Let's start with narrative. Narrative, that's a big genre. And when we say, what does a narrative do? What does that genre do that other genres don't do or don't do as well? We could come up with a list of 50 or 100 different answers to that. But if you clustered them all together, you would come out with sort of two big chunks or clusters, and they are: narrative creates a world. When you move into narrative, you move into a kind of self-contained world. When my children were quite small, it was sometimes my responsibility to read a bedtime story to them and then get them off to bed. I would often let them pick whatever book they wanted me to read. And for a season there, every night, all they wanted me to read was the Golden Books version of The Big Bad Wolf and The Three Little Pigs. So we'd sit there. They'd be in their snuggly little pajamas with the duck's feet, and I would be there with the Walt Disney Golden Book version of The Big Bad Wolf and The Three Little Pigs. And if I was tired that night, I would, you know, kind of like skip a pig or two, get them off to bed. But it wasn't long before not only could I not skip a pig or two, I couldn't skip a thee, an of, an it, or an and. They couldn't read, but they had memorized this story, and it had become a fixed liturgical text from which we could not depart. And I thought, why in the world do 3- and 4-year-olds have this kind of literary rigidity? Why can't we be flexible here? And I came home one afternoon. My son was sitting in the middle of the living room. My daughter was hiding behind the draperies, and I saw her, as she pulled the draperies over her, say, "I'm in my house of bricks." And she saw me come in the door, and she said, "And here comes the big bad wolf." What she was doing, of course, was living in the world of the story and processing her life through the story. And that's what stories do. And what happens, of course, is when you come out of the story, then you have to compare the world that you really live in with the world that you have just been in the story. And sometimes you say, gosh, I wonder if I could do what is necessary to make my world like this world I've just lived in. Or sometimes you say, like Dickens' A Christmas Carol, oh my gosh, how can I do what is necessary to keep my world from becoming like the world that I just lived in? Or you might even say, I wonder if my world really is like that world if I knew how to look and I knew how to live. Sometimes the gospel story gives us all of those different comparisons. The second big cluster of things that stories do better than other genres do is they create identification with character. They create identification with character. You go to a play or a movie or you read a novel and you find yourself sympathetically connected to one of the characters because that character connects with you. William Meal, in his book of sermons, All the Damned Angels, tells the story about the day that he and his wife went to the nursery school to pick up their nursery school age son. It was a big day, because this was just before Christmas holidays, and the children had been preparing Christmas gifts for their parents, and they were going to present them to them this day. Well, Meal and his wife arrived just at the same time that another couple arrived to pick up their son. They headed down the corridor together, and the other couple's son poked his head out of his classroom, saw his parents coming, ran back into the classroom, came back out into the corridor, and he had a big gaily wrapped box with a bow on it, and he came running down the hallway toward his parents with this big box for them. And his little feet got twisted up, and he hit the floor, and there was this awful ceramic crash from inside the box. And the little boy dissolved into tears there on the floor. His father walked over to him and said, "Don't cry, son. It doesn't matter." But his mother, far wiser, said as she got down on the floor with her son, "It does matter. Oh, but it does matter." Now, I hear a story like that and I say, I wonder which of those characters I'm like. Am I the kind of parent or pastor who says, "They're there. It doesn't matter"? Or do I get down on the floor with my people and cry with them? It does matter. Does matter. Stories create identification with character. Now let's take a look at a couple of examples of stories. The first, I can't get it all on the screen at the same time, is the 20th chapter of John. Now this is, of course, the resurrection appearances of Jesus in the Gospel of John. And what I want you to notice here is the array of characters that are found in this narrative. Because what I think you have here is a series of five episodes presenting a different character or group of characters, each experiencing the resurrection in a different way. Let's look at it. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the tomb. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to them, "They've taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they've laid him." Then Peter and the other disciple set out and went toward the tomb. The two were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent down to look in and saw the linen wrappings lying there, but he didn't go in. Then Simon Peter came following him and went into the tomb. He saw the linen wrappings lying there and the cloth that had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. Then the other disciple who reached the tomb first also went in. He saw and believed. Character number one, the other disciple sees nothing and believes everything. Now, I think that represents characters who are in your congregation who have always believed. They don't know how. They don't know when. They've just always believed. But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had been lying, one at the head, the other at the feet. They said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said, "They've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they've laid him." When she'd said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she didn't know that it was Jesus. Jesus said, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you've laid him, and I'll take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him in Hebrew, "Rabboni," which means teacher. There's another character, Mary, who believes in the resurrection when it becomes personal, when her name is named. When it was evening on that day, the first day of the week, and the doors of the house where the disciples had met were locked for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After this, he showed them his hands and side, and then the disciples rejoiced when they saw the Lord. Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, so I send you." When he said this, he breathed on them and said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven them. If you retain the sins of any, they are retained." Now, there's a whole list of non sequiturs. I mean, why is he breathing? Why is he saying, "Peace be with you"? Why is he talking about forgiveness of sins? Do you know what that is? That's the language of the church. The breathing on them is baptism. The showing the hands inside is the Lord's Supper. The "peace be with you" is liturgy. The if you forgive, you will be forgiven. If you retain, they will be retained. That's church discipline. There's some people like the beloved disciple who've always believed. There's some people like Mary who believe in the resurrection when it's personal. And there's some people who believe through the life and liturgy of the church. But Thomas, who was called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciple told him, "We have seen the Lord," but he said to them, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands and put my finger in the mark of the nails in my hand inside, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand. Put them in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." And Thomas said, "My Lord and my God." Some people, the beloved disciples, see nothing and believe everything. Some like Mary when it becomes personal. Some like the disciples through the ministry of the church. Some like Thomas through a tough intellectual process, testing doubt and being made available to that doubt. So on Easter Sunday, when you're preaching on the 20th chapter of John and you're looking out at that group of people that you haven't seen since Christmas, instead of saying, "What are you people doing here?" You recognize in the 20th chapter of John that people come to the resurrection in a variety of ways, and all of them are there. "Have you believed because you've seen?" Jesus says to Thomas. "Blessed are those who believe because they haven't seen," talking to your Easter congregation. That's character. Now, not only do narratives have characters, narratives also have plots, and preachers need to pay attention to plots. Have you ever looked at the plot structure of a text and seen how the thing is shaped and moved? Plots have beginnings, middles, and ends. And what you want to ask yourself is, what do I have at the end of a story that I didn't have at the beginning of the story, and how did the middle get me there? For example, here's how the story of Ruth in the Old Testament begins. In the time of the judges, which every Hebrew reader would know meant before we had no king, there was a famine in the land. Oh my gosh, not only is there no king, there's no food. There was this man named Elimelech. He was married to a woman named Naomi, and they had two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. Mahlon and Chilion, by the way, are Hebrew words meaning, we think, weakness and consumption. Have you met my two boys? Weakness and consumption. They go to the land of Moab to get away from the famine, and weakness and consumption marry Moabite women, Ruth and Orpah. And then Elimelech dies, which is a sad thing, but not to worry. The Hebrew line can continue as long as you have sons. And we have sons, we have weakness and consumption. And then, surprise, surprise, weakness and consumption die as well. No king, no food, no son. As if to underscore the point, Naomi says to her daughters-in-law, "Go marry other men. I have no more sons in my womb." One of them, Orpah, does, but Ruth stays with his mother-in-law, with their mother-in-law, and they go back to Bethlehem. And when they get back to Bethlehem, the other women say, "Is that Naomi?" And Naomi says, "Don't you call me Naomi. I am no longer Naomi. You can call me ticked off." The Hebrew word there is marah, and it means bitter, ticked off. No king, no food, no son, no name. No king, no food, no son, no name. "The Lord took me away full, but brought me back," said Naomi, "empty." That's the cheerful beginning of the book of Ruth. Have you ever noticed how it ends? There's the beginning, let's look at the end. Ruth and Boaz have gotten together and they've had a son, and the women in the town say, "Oh, to Naomi," she's got her name back, "a son has been born." Actually, it was born to Ruth, but it's a minor point. "To To Naomi, a son has been born. Name, son, what does Naomi do? She takes the baby to her breast and she feeds him. Name, son, food. And then the narrator says, they call the boy Obed. He became the father of Jesse, who became the father of the best king we ever had. Notice how the ending of the story and the plot structure has built step by step back up what we lost at the beginning. We have fullness and extravagance in the end. We have lack and poverty in the beginning. How did we get there in the middle? There's the key thing. How does the plot turn? The critical scene is when Naomi figures out the only way out of this is for Ruth to use her sexual charms to seduce Boaz into doing what no self-respecting Hebrew would ever do, and that is keep the law of Levirate marriage. The law of Levirate marriage was like tithing. Everybody agreed to it, but nobody actually did it. So Naomi says, what I want you to do is I want you to put on your best dress. I want you to put on a little perfume, evening in Jerusalem. I want you to go down to the threshing floor, and when Boaz has eaten and drunk, I want you to uncover his feet. And he will tell you what to do. She almost does it. She puts on her best dress, she puts on the perfume, she goes down to the threshing floor, she uncovers his feet when he is eaten and drunk, and then she tells him what to do. You ever notice that little twist in the plot? You are the next of kin, she says. You fulfill your covenant obligation. Who is she to say that? She's a woman. Who is she to say that? She's a Moabite, an outsider. But Boaz does it. When the outsider calls the insider to his own faith and he obeys, the plot turns from emptiness to fullness. When the outsider calls the church to our own gospel, and we don't say, who are you to, but we respond in obedience, the extravagance of the mercy of God is experienced. It's in the plot structure. Now, let's take a look at another plot. This one is a familiar story. This is the Zacchaeus story. Now, I want to show you something about the Zacchaeus story. It's in the 19th chapter of Luke. He entered Jericho and was passing through. I've been in towns like that. A man was there named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was short in stature. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore tree to see him, because he was going to pass that way. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come on down, for I must stay at your house today. So he hurried down and was happy to welcome him. All who saw it began to grumble and said, he's gone in to be the guest of one who is a sinner. Zacchaeus stood there and said, now wait a minute. If you're following the normal narrative logic of this, we've got Jesus entering into the town, Zacchaeus up in the tree. Jesus calls Zacchaeus down from the tree. So far, so good. They go to Zacchaeus' house, but suddenly we have simultaneous action on both ends of the narrative stage here. On one end of the narrative stage, you've got Zacchaeus rejoicing. If I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay it back. And Jesus says, salvation has come to this house, and there's a... And on the other side of the narrative screen, they're grumbling, murmuring like the old Israelis in the desert. He's gone in to be with a sinner. He's eating in there with him. Grumble, grumble, grumble. Joy, joy, joy. Grumble, grumble, grumble. Joy, joy, joy. And you're watching a tennis match. Back and forth, you're going simultaneously, trying to decide which end of this narrative stage do you want to... Which is precisely the plot point. Do you want to remain outside the house and grumble at what the kingdom is doing in our midst? Or do you want to be inside the house where the rejoicing and the repenting and the saving is going on. The plot comes at you with stereophonic literary effect, demanding a decision. Where are you going to stand on the literary stage? Plots and characters. We also have, and this is the final thing we'll look at narratives, and then we'll look at one more genre, Psalms. They also have settings. Now, I don't have this text for you, but I'm going to read it to you. It's from the 6th chapter of Mark, and I want you to listen to where this takes place, and I want you to be very careful as you listen, because the writer is going to really upset you if you pay careful attention. There is a literary speed bump here, and if you're moving too fast, you will feel the jolt. Listen. See if you can spot where the speed bump is. The apostles gathered around Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. He said to them, "Come away to a desert, all by yourselves, and rest for a while." For many were coming and going, and they hadn't even had any time to eat. So they went away in a boat to a desert by themselves. But many saw them going there, and they recognized them, and so they hurried there on foot from all the towns, and they got there ahead of them. As he went ashore, he saw then a great crowd, and he had compassion for them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. When it grew late, his disciples said to him, "This is a desert. The hour is very late. Send them away so that they may go into the surrounding country and villages to buy something for themselves to eat." But he said, "No, you give them something to eat." And they said, "Are we to go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?" And he said, "Well, how many loaves have you? Go and see." When they found out, they said, "Five and 2 fish. Then he ordered them to get all the people to sit down in groups on the green. He ordered them to get all the people to sit down in groups on the green grass. Wait a minute, where are we? We've been told 3 times we are in a desert, and suddenly we have green grass. Now, that's theoretically possible, but it's literally very interesting that the desert is beginning to get green on us. Mark is not a Technicolor writer. He never says things like, "Jesus was wearing a brown robe and matching tan sandals as he stood under the azure sky." That is not his style. Suddenly we're hit with this green grass jumping out in the desert. Now, the original Markan readers were far more competent in the Old Testament than we are, and so generically, they knew how to read this story, and when they read this story, they got to the place that the grass in the desert turned green, and you know where their minds went. Isaiah. "The desert shall blossom." When? In the Messianic age. Wow. The desert is turning green on us. Not only that, he made them to sit down on the green grass. He maketh them to sit down on the green. He maketh them to lie down. Yeah, that's a psalm, isn't it? How does that thing start? Oh, yeah, "The Lord is my..." Back up at verse 34, it said, "He had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd, and he made them lie down in green pastures." Wow! Using the setting of a narrative, the writer has galvanized 2 powerful Old Testament images, which is much more powerful for the reader than saying, "Jesus here was both shepherd and Messiah." When you can allow it to happen in the imagination of the reader, it's much more powerful. Setting and plot and character. Now let's look at one more genre, and then we have to quit. The genre of Psalms. Psalms aren't like narratives. Psalms are liturgical poetry. And like all poetry, they come at you with more voltage per word than prose does. They have a kind of emotive power. Now, how do they achieve that emotive power? Sometimes they achieve it through images. Read sometimes Psalm 1. We won't take time to read it. But you'll find there a contrasting image which makes a powerful preaching device. Blessed is the man who walks not, sits not, scorns not, all these verbs that you don't do, but rather is like a tree planted by the river. Suddenly you have contrasting images of motion and stability. And the one who is stable murmurs Torah day and night, meditates on the law of God. But over here, the wind is blowing and they're like chaff blown around. Suddenly you have restlessness, instability, insecurity. Now, if you don't see our culture in that, you can't see. Blown around, don't know who they are. In Judith Guest's book, Ordinary People, there's a middle-aged man who says, you know, every time I'm in a restaurant or an elevator and I hear somebody start a conversation, now I'm the kind of man who I lean over in hopes of getting some wisdom, but I'm always disappointed. And finally, I have to conclude, I'm the kind of man who hasn't got any idea what kind of man I am. Like chaff, the wind blows it away. The righteous are not so, like trees planted. Powerful, poetic, contrasting images of stability and restlessness. Not only images, but psalms use powerful moods. Listen to this psalm, Psalm 70. Be pleased, O God, to deliver me. O God, make haste to help me. Let those be put to shame and confusion who seek my life. Let them be turned back who want to dishonor me, who want to hurt me. Let them say, aha, aha, turn their back because of their shame. Let all who seek you rejoice and be glad. Let those who love your salvation say, God is great. I'm poor and needy. O God, you're my help and deliverer. O God, don't delay, don't delay. I wasn't taught to pray like that. I was taught to pray like Psalm 40. I waited patiently for the Lord. Two moods. The panic-struck prayer of a person in deep crisis and the calm, tranquil prayer of one rooted in the faith. I am comforted, by the way, by the fact that at the end of Psalm 40, some editor has tacked on, be pleased, O God, to deliver me. O Lord, make haste to help me. Psalm 70 has been tacked on the end of Psalm 40 out of an awareness that on Sabbath day, when you look out at your congregation, for everybody out there praying in the mood, I waited patiently for the Lord. There's somebody else praying, O Lord, hurry up and help me. Differing moods in the Psalms. And finally, the structure of the Psalms. Let's take a look at the structure of Psalm 77. Psalm 77 is a typical lament psalm, and it begins this way. Oh, by the way, as I read this, what I want you to try to spot in this psalm is structurally, what would you say is the fulcrum of this psalm? Where does this psalm turn? As most lament psalms do, they turn from lament to praise. And I want you to see if you can spot where the fulcrum is. I cry aloud to God that he may help me. In the day of my trouble, I seek the Lord. In the night, my hand is stretched without wearying. My soul refuses to be comforted. I think of God and I moan. I meditate, my spirit faints. You keep my eyelids from closing. I'm so troubled I cannot speak. I consider the days of old. I remember years of long ago. I commune with my heart in the night. I meditate and search my spirit. Will the Lord spurn forever and never again be favorable? Has your steadfast love ceased forever? Are your promises at an end for all time? You've forgotten to be gracious. You in your anger have shut up your compassion. It is my grief that God is no longer powerful. Or as the NRSV puts, it is my grief that the right hand of the Most High has changed. I will call to mind the deeds of the Lord. I will remember your wonders of old. I will meditate on all your work and muse on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is so great as our God? You are the God who works wonders. You've displayed your might among the peoples. With your strong arm you redeemed your people, the descendants of Jacob and Joseph. When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. The very deep trembled, the clouds poured out water, the skies thundered, your arrows flashed on every side, the crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind, your lightnings lit up the world, and the earth trembled and shook. Your way was through the sea, your path through the mighty waters, yet your footprints were unseen. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. Now, where was the turning point in that? If you guessed verse 11, you're absolutely right. There was the fulcrum point where suddenly, after 10 verses of spewing out grief and rage, the psalmist makes a vow, I will meditate on your mighty works. Now, what in the world happens in the middle of that psalm? I will remember your deeds. Well, memory is no trick. As a matter of fact, earlier in the psalm, he remembered stuff and it didn't do anything but create more anguish and grief for him. What is it about memory in the middle of the psalm that turns the psalm from lament to praise? He remembers the historical events in which God was active and redemptive. And in doing so, the Exodus is the one that he remembers. He discovers some fascinating things. Your way was through the sea, not around it, but through it. Not bypassing the trouble, but right through the middle of the trouble. Number two, you were not seen. Your footprints were unseen. We were led by people like Moses and Aaron, but you were hidden in the background. And in the discovery of remembering that event, the power of God through the problem in a hidden way, we move not only from lament to praise, but did you notice how the language of this psalm changed from I to you? I am so troubled, I cannot speak. I remember days of old. I. The first 10 verses are all I. But after the fulcrum, you, O God. Your way is holy. You. Walter Brueggemann says we have the transformation from narcissistic whining to other-directed praise in the structure of this psalm.